You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 21st of September 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
The UN General Assembly convenes, though one attendee is struggling to find dinner. Should governments bail out struggling energy companies and or struggling journalists? And remembering Mexico 1970, the most picturesque of World Cups. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Daniela Pellet and Yossi Meckelberg, will be here to discuss all the day's big stories. That's coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Daniela Pellet, Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Yossi Meckelberg, Associate Fellow with the Middle East and North Africa Program at Chatham House. Hello to you both.
Hello.
We will be discussing a story later in the show which does pertain to pizza, so I wanted to cunningly foreshadow that with our designated light introductory banter section here at the start of the program. I thought I would throw the pineapple question open to the floor. Pineapple on pizza, do you have any strong opinions on this either way, Daniela?
I've got a very strong opinion. It's that I don't care.
You strongly don't care about pineapple on pizza?
I strongly don't care. If someone put pineapple on a pizza and I was hungry, I would eat it. If they didn't, I would not miss it.
Okay, that's... I can't really work with that.
No, I've given you nothing. I protest. Like, I protest this whole line of banter.
I know. It's like that's a cowardly each way bet Daniela has placed there. Yossi, do you have a strong, deeply held view on pineapple on pizza?
Very strong. It's just plainly wrong. You don't mix between the two. I prefer pineapple in an ice cream, but not on a pizza.
This means
just plain wrong, Daniela. Yeah. What have you got to say to that?
I think my survival chances in the zombie apocalypse are much higher now if I think of the fussy eaters there are in this room.
Well, this has set the tone for the cut and thrust, which will follow from here on. But let's start with the 76th session of the United Nations General Assembly, which kicked off today in New York, which probably can't hurt. Joe Biden did his first turn as US president before the thing and went big on the necessity for global cooperation at a turning point in our shared history, etc., which on the one hand is about the most predictable thing an occupant of his office can possibly say at such a moment, but on the other hand is a significant and or reassuring shift in tone from the previous bloke. Daniela, are you excited, agog, or as indifferent as you are re-pineapple on pizza to see the UN General Assembly back in business?
Well, I hate to continue a theme here. Yeah, it rolls around every year. It's quite nice to see them doing some stuff in person. You know, it's all a bit of... political theatre. I would have been quite excited to see Biden's debut had it not been for the events of the last few months in Afghanistan, which has rather taken the gloss of anything that he might achieve going forward in his presidency. And now I'm just wondering whether he will actually stay awake for the whole proceedings, which is not particularly interesting. It's, again, clearly all the usual markers are there. It's going to be overshadowed by coronavirus, by Afghanistan, by climate change, by this new supposed Cold War between the US and China, which really isn't that new, ongoing conflict, and the usual prepared statements and meet and greets, really.
On that thought, Yossi, this idea that Biden might have a bit of bridge building to do following recent events, he does, of course, have going for him in that regard that he is not Donald Trump, whose presence at these conclaves used to rather bewilder and or amuse the other participants. But will he have to make some effort to get back on side with not necessarily America's traditional enemies, but America's traditional allies, many of whom are miffed about Afghanistan and or this new thing called AUKUS?
And I think this is one of the points when he talks about unity in the world, but at the same time, build a new partnership, which is all about the backyard of China. So there are many contradictions in Biden's strategy, which some of them one can understand because it's complex to be the president of the most powerful country in the world. You need to juggle a lot of boulders. But having said that, I think it's important that it takes place after 1 year virtually. And then not being Trump is always an advantage because you, in a way, you know what you're going to get from Biden. It's not going to alienate too many people. He will say the things that you expect. Climate change should unite us. China should divide us. Iran, we should make sure it doesn't have nuclear. So it will create some sanity, more civility in the United Nations that you didn't have when Trump visits basically anywhere. But I think also to bring the world together around the recovery post-pandemic. We are just before the COP26. It's around the corner. So how many can you create actually the critical mass that can deal with it seriously? And also specifically to rally the U.S. allies, whether it's in NATO, the European Union. You know better about it in Australia, which now became a major strategic place.
Daniela, does the United Nations still, not the United Nations, rather the United States still fulfill that role of default leader of absolutely everything? Is it still the case that the rest of the world doesn't really get its act together collectively unless the United States leads it there?
Well, now Angela Merkel is leaving the scene, rather puts the emphasis back on Washington. I don't know. I think it is important to have a strong democratic power in the world and so on. But, I wish I could be as excited as Yossi about Biden beyond the fact that he's not Trump, which the excitement of that has long ago worn off. I think he has very little credibility. Maybe I'm too focused on what happened in Afghanistan, but that's just an appalling and cataclysmic foreign policy failure. And so it's hard to see how he's going to have gravitas talking about intervention or talking about power, talking about allies. The map shifted during the Trump era as well. America is no longer playing the same kind of role that it was. And, the UN as well is a slightly bogus format for these kinds of grandstanding gestures because it's a format for politics. It's a forum, but change doesn't actually happen at the UN General Assembly.
Just a final quick thought on that, Yossi. Does the UN actually serve a practical as well as a symbolic purpose? Which is not to say there is no symbolic or that there is no value in having some sort of symbolic forum at which the world's leaders gather and at least pretend to engage with each other. But does it actually accomplish anything much beyond that anymore?
Symbolism, as you say, plays a very important role in diplomacy and international affairs, but it's not enough. There are structural issues there because the decisions are taken in the Security Council and worse, they don't take place in the Security Council because of the structure itself. It's when one country or five countries have veto, it's enough for one of them to stop the rest of the world from operating in a certain way. And that's where the United Nations need urgently acutely reforms, but it doesn't happen because the same countries that will lose some of their power will block this reform. And as long as this is not resolved, I think we'll see, and I agree with Daniel, it's became more grandstanding. But there is an element, grandstanding can be sometimes important as well.
The thing the UN does really well is the kind of quite dull stuff like culture and health and collecting statistics. That's great. I think we expect the UN to be the major, the goodies in the world, and they manage to solve all the problems and stop the wars. Not so good at that.
But that's where, for instance, the League of Nations failed, and they had the grand idea of Woodrow Wilson. And that's the UN was supposed to be an improvement of the League of Nations. It is an improvement, but far from what we would like it to be.
Well, let us now shift from the foreign to the domestic. And the UK's government has hastened to reassure that it is alarmist and misguided to begin talking about gas shortages. So we should probably start talking about gas shortages. Even more alarmingly, Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng has said that there is no question of lights going out, homes languishing unheated, a three-day work working week, although for reference, Kwarteng was also one of those people who said Brexit would be both easy and beneficial. But a gas crunch is looming. Energy and food bills will rise, and energy suppliers may well go bust. The question posed is, at what point should a government step in? Daniela, is there an argument that the market cannot always be relied upon to sort these things out for itself, which was the great argument behind privatising things like energy in the first place?
Well, it's definitely an argument for that. But I think people's approach to this is very much judged on where on the political spectrum they fall. Those on the left might say, well, capitalism is bad. Let's not bring it into national utilities. And those on the right will say, oh, the market is king and it can solve all the problems. And although I'm the only female in this studio, I would say that, you know, as a classic centrist dad, I would like to see the middle ground. You know, it works for some things. It doesn't work for others. But certainly when there's a crisis like this, and it does seem to be a looming crisis, yet another looming crisis, it's inconceivable the government doesn't step in. That's what they need to do in the short term. In the longer term, that's a different question. In the longer term, governments are supposed to manage the economy, and theoretically, if they do a bad job, we vote them out. That doesn't always happen.
Indeed not. Yossi, there is a weird thing demonstrated here, isn't there, that there are some industries which are kind of exempted to a large extent from a rigorous free market approach because the government can't let them fail, because if the government does let them fail, then the entire social contract will break down and the government overseeing all that will likely get slung out at the next election, and quite rightly. We saw this back in 2008-2009 when this government, among many around the world, spent absolute fortunes of our money in order to bail out a bunch of crooked, greedy and irresponsible bankers, because they did understand that the alternative to that was money not coming out of cash machines, at which point everything would go a bit nuts, as it would if everybody's lights went off and their heating didn't come on.
And the same scenario is repeating itself. And at the end of the day, we should be owners of these banks because we paid for it from our taxes. So there is a model there that they're too big to fail. And these companies, whether it's bank or utilities or transport, there is free market as long as they make money, as long as it enriches shareholders. The minute that they fail, and they fail at their own account, then someone else needs to bail them out. So they never can lose. Now, small businesses can't do that. Private individuals can't do that because they will go bankrupt. But utilities, because they have the power to tell, because they know what's the electoral power. But for instance, talking about power, if you won't have gas, natural gas, in the middle of a cold winter. And when the minister talks about, oh, lights will stay on and everyone will be able to heat their house, this is not correct, because prices would go up. The government is not going to regulate the prices because it's against what the Tory believed in. And many people probably will sit in the dark and in the cold, and the most vulnerable will end like this while they are cutting the universal benefits. And this is the danger. They should guarantee that the most vulnerable will be protected. And yes, they can fail, but then ensuring and regulate the prices. And part of these utilities, they are not in free market environment. They actually created segregated monopolies, not free market.
Daniela, are you calmed at all by the reassurances of the government that this is just a short-term problem, it won't be that bad, really, it'll all be grand?
Well, I'm not at all, but then also at this point in 2021, I'm also quite numb. And the idea of shortages of food and so on doesn't really fill me with the same huge peril that it might have done a year and a half ago. It's interesting to look, though, at the way that different governments are dealing with this around Europe as well, how more socialist governments, like in Spain, are taking a very different approach to the one we have here. I just hope that, again, ideological stance of the Conservatives, ideological stance on this is not going to get in the way of, we have long-term planning to do, but the short-term planning of the winter, which hits us after coronavirus, probably another wave of Delta, and which, as you said, people are going to be very vulnerable.
This is the government that says that the pandemic, the COVID-19, is like flu and it will go after the winter. So
That is true. They have said a number of optimistic things over the last couple of years, which haven't quite worked out as advertised. Yossi, I just want to go back to that point Daniela made earlier, that this is one of those things, like actually now that I think of it, pretty much everything else that ever happens, which people do respond to by going, well, this just proves that I was right all along. But there is already, and there will be more, of a hue and cry for the idea of energy providers and providers of other essential accoutrements to life being nationalised. But is that the nostalgia of people who've forgotten what state-owned energy and communications and other such monopolies were like? Because I have lived in this country long enough that I just about remember those, and they were not an advertisement for the public sector.
No, and we need to learn from both experiences because neither of them worked. So how we find, as Daniela said earlier, about also, I don't want to use the third way because this has been misused before, but in a way that works. It's not about renationalizing it, it's about regulating it. It's about when not dealing with it only when there is crisis, but anticipate, building the scenarios when it happened. So if a year ago or so, you could get oil for free, as long as you store it in your backyard, you could get just have some oil. This is not the case. This is not the case now. That's what government's for, to plan ahead, to build on scenarios from between oil is zero price, $0 per gallon, then where natural gas goes up. But that's what they don't do with each of these issues. They deal from crisis to crisis. This is where the crux of the matter.
We should probably advise listeners against storing oil in their back garden. It would probably create more problems than it solves. Yossi Meckelberg and Daniela Pellard, thank you both for the moment. This is The Monocle Daily. I will be back with more from our panel right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Oliver Bater has been the CEO of Allianz since 2015. Oliver Bater, it's great to talk with you. Beyond those risks and challenges, how does Allianz serve the arts and culture community?
So we're really trying to understand what are the existential risks that people have, whether you are an actor, you know, what happens when you fall sick and you can't participate in a production, you can't be on stage, how do you protect that? It's very basic things like health. If you have a severe sickness, how do you bring people back to work? And the point around, it's not just about payment. Think about the fact that, you know, you can't do a production. Can you help with sourcing? Can you create another, you know, maybe a country becomes a high incidence? Can you help to find other locations for production? So we are not just paying for claims, we're actually trying to help with the services that are required around the risks that can emerge. And we're doing it in many, 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 many ways.
Oliver Bater, CEO of Allianz, explaining why with Allianz you can take confidence in tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to The Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Daniela Pellard and Yossi Meckelberg. Let's stick with the theme of governments bailing out entities left economically woebegone by prevailing circumstances, but move on from providers of such relative fripperies as food and energy to something that really matters, i.e. freelance journalists. Let it never be said that The Daily has an agenda. France, over the next couple of years, will make available €29.5 million to freelance hacks whose income has been dinged by the COVID-19 pandemic. Outrageously, and you can bet I checked, having a go-betweens interview syndicated by Les in Rock Up Tib about 20 years ago turns out to be insufficient qualification. Daniela, all jokes aside, this is good, right? Our fellow scriveners rescued by a munificent government.
That's such a pity you're putting all jokes aside, because I have so many jokes I would like to make on this. But you're right, it is a serious issue, and I'm kind of surprised. I would have thought that freelance journalists were at the bottom of the heap when it came to handouts like this. But of course, I'm going to be a big fan of the importance of media support and development, and this works in the developed world as well as the developing. What the questions I do have, though, being slightly cynical, occasionally cynical, is how, in this context, you also define a journalist. Are we going to talk about people who are freelance content creators or people who make their living on social media? So that would be quite an interesting breakdown, and I don't know whether that even comes into it in this French system.
Yossi, it's one of those things. It sounds like a lot of money, 29.5 million euros, and indeed it will be if only like four people get it together to apply for them. That's going to be a result for them. But is there at what point do you start suggesting it's not really the state's problem?
I think for a democracy, it's important to have free journalism. And I'm not all against free journalism, being part of it and coming to that. You know, you're both of you seasoned journalists. I came later in life into journalism, and actually think having freelancers that kind of less connected on a daily basis with the institution themselves creates some freedom in mm-hmm. what you do. And if the government, as part of a democratic system, supports freelancer in doing all sorts of things, that maybe being part of institutions of and having the payslip every month would hinder them from doing, it's not a bad thing. Again, whether 29 million is enough or not depends how many journalists there are in France. But the idea that they're encouraged, and there is a mixed model of journalism that part of them work in a single establishment and others actually can roam the planet and do different things and bring and create new knowledge is not all bad.
Is there, however, a concern, Daniela, that this might entrench the reluctance of certain media outlets to actually pay their freelancers?
Yeah, well, this is a more of a systemic problem in journalism as well. And you know how the situation is in France, but here life is tough for freelance journalists and only getting tougher. And you wouldn't imagine that people would still be offered to be paid in exposure or tweets. But yeah, this happens, and this is one of those instances where, I mean, it is great, I think, because I'm part of the industry, that a government is stepping in to support it. But if you're talking about when should the government intervene, it would be better to have a more sustainable media ecosystem, and one that valued quality content as well as just the usual sort of journalism that fuels the beast.
Just to follow that up, Daniela, because this is very much the area in which you work, journalism around the world, do you get any sense yet that moving on from the idea of furloughing temporarily disadvantaged journalists or subsidising them, do you get the sense that the way the media works has been changed in any particularly profound and lasting way by the pandemic? Are you sort of running across people being much more reliant on, for example, Zoom rather than going places and talking to people?
Yeah, it's been actually dangerous to be a journalist over the last couple of years. If people, there's a limited amount of reporting you can do virtually. I mean, it's very useful, but a large part of reporting is, if not being frontline, is actually talking to people and going places. But also in terms of the kind of the sort of reporting that there is, the important things, it's changed dramatically. That disinformation has never been at the kind of peak that it is now. And journalists are sort of frontline of combating them. And also, you know, in the economic downturn, media is not necessarily in the front line. So this is certainly this has had a huge impact on journalism everywhere around the world.
Jossi, what have you made of that same question, I guess? Because you would have hoped that this would have been a moment at which people re-embraced and rediscovered all over again actually properly reported journalism and reliable information and so forth. But there does seem to be a not small cohort of people who have gone ever further out of their way to find unreliable information.
And I think this is... let's not conflate between what pandemic did to journalism and what social media did to journalism. And I think freelancing as such doesn't intervene with it. It's probably there is a room, but as long as the journalists are well-trained and there is a professionalism within the field, within the sector, this is the most important thing. Obviously, with social media, when there is so much fake news, unreliable information, and we know that the way that also, and I happen to teach course in media and communication, is in different from the past, is how you decipher, how you differentiate between reliable information. It's about critical reading and the kind of information that is fake, which is so much there. So actually, we need to reinforce the professionalism and as a profession, journalism is a profession. So it's we have almost more responsibility than ever in history when it comes to journalism.
Well, returning to the UN General Assembly, and here is where the scintillating pizza banter at the top of the show will make sense. Let us now hear it for New York City's restaurateurs who have demonstrated that the no jab, no service rules will brook no exemptions. Not even, it turns out, President Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil. Bolsonaro has thus far ostentatiously refused to take a COVID-19 vaccine and perhaps, who knows, thereby set an example to his nation, which has now lost at least 600,000 people to the virus. That he has been forced to hastily scoff takeaway pizza on the sidewalk is perhaps not appropriate karmic retribution, but it's something. Here, first of all, is Penny Ebewadena, International Affairs Commissioner for New York City, explaining the city's policy and its dealings with the international community.
We have a citywide policy called Key to NYC, and this requires you to show your vaccination card to be able to enjoy any sort of indoor entertainment. And so this was the attitude that we also took in terms of working with the U.S. mission to the UN and the President of the General Assembly and the Secretariat to ensuring that vaccinations are at the heart of how people navigate, not only UNGA, but how they navigate New York City while they're here. It is absolutely, you know, complicated. It is not the easiest thing, but it is something that we have had an extreme amount of support from member states, from the President of the General Assembly. And so we are, you know, looking forward to the UN and that community enforcing it. But that is something that is very important to New York City, is they are here vaccinated, tested, masking, socially distancing where they can to ensure the utmost safety for New Yorkers.
Daniela, she has put it extremely tactfully there, as is her job, but that basically boils down to the great sort of New Yorkish don't care who you are, no shirt, no service.
Absolutely, absolutely. And although in the UK, really not sure about this kind of vaccine passports for access to services, because I think public health issues, it's much better to persuade and educate rather than compel. In this case, I couldn't be happier.
So basically, you're doing that thing of thinking the rules should be adjusted in terms of who they're going to inconvenience.
Generally, I'm all for fair and free treatment, but I really think Mr. Bolsonaro had this coming.
He did have it coming, Jossi. There's no doubt about that. But the trouble is, and this is where, unfortunately, it's very hard to win with the likes of President Bolsonaro, is that, you know, the photo of him being scoffing pizza on the sidewalk has, of course, been amplified by his own crowd. This is actually going to play massively well for him among his base, isn't it? Like, I went to New York City and those fancy pants, book learning, uptown science believers wouldn't let me dine in their fancy pants uptown book learning restaurants, and so here I am having to eat pizza on the sidewalk like the humble sentinel of the people that I am.
Well, I feel about Bolsonaro what I feel about pineapple on a pizza. So it's definitely no.
I have not been able to ascertain whether, in fact, Bolsonaro did have pineapple on his pizza.
I think we should inquire. But to be honest, it's it shows the kind of the crisis that we have between those who believe in science and those who decide as a matter of popularity to defy science. So, you know, Bolsonaro kicked out 12,000 medical staff, Cuban ones, because he didn't like them, just to find out that during pandemic he doesn't have enough doctors and nurses and others, because that's the way Bolsonaro acts. So he doesn't believe that there is a pandemic. He doesn't believe in vaccination. And I think maybe it's a lesson to be learned for him that, yeah, in some parts of New York he's unwelcome. I think actually should not allow him actually to enter into the United States if he endangers the population, because this is about survival right now. And in the United States, it was reported yesterday 2,000 people died from COVID-19. It's a serious matter. So if this populist and the United States managed to get rid of one populist, I think they shouldn't necessarily let another one to visit.
Danielle, there is that serious point, and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio had already suggested this, not just denying Jair Bolsonaro entry to New York pizza parlors, but denying him entry to the United States. And a member of his delegation has indeed tested positive, and they are frantically trying to track down everybody he might have come into contact with, and how you spend any amount of time in New York City without coming into contact with loads of people is beyond me. Shouldn't the United States have just said to him, well, either you demonstrate that you've been vaccinated or you're not coming?
Well, you know, talking about populism and populists, that would have been an even bigger boon to his profile at home. So it's a bit of a no-win situation. And I think, as you said, the way it's panned out with the pizza on the street incident really says quite a lot about that New York vibe, and I think made the point in a way that we can relish and he will exploit no matter what we do.
But just as a final thought on this, Yossi, do you see any end in sight to the degree to which that anti-vax sentiment has started to become a political catalyst in a lot of parts of the world? I mean, I obviously paid attention to this because Australia is where I'm from, but we do not often see in Australian cities, as we have seen in the last day or so in Melbourne, riots of such violence that the police are compelled to launch baton rounds to try to disperse them.
And it divides society, but it's a very similar argument with climate change between those who say it does exist and those who say no, it's they deny climate change. I think this is really the demarcation of the default lines between those who think we should follow science, we should follow knowledge, and don't think that populism and ignorance. And yes, I look cool because I ate pizza without vaccination, so I'm so cool, and I'll get more support. This is exactly the battle that we have on our hands, and we should. I think those who believe in science should roll our sleeves and be ready for this fight.
Daniela, it is just finally on today's panel a question I know I have asked in tones of rhetorical exasperation from this chair before, but how have we got to a point where we have, as a species, managed to turn into yet another nonsense culture war issue, a completely morally indifferent force of nature like a virus? It doesn't care.
We haven't done this on our own, to be fair, and I wouldn't underestimate the amount of deliberate disinformation and misinformation around this and how much it's been used as a destabilizing force by political actors, most notably and successfully Russia, but others as well. So I think people are herd animals. That sounds too much like herd immunity. But we are very, very easily influenced. And this particular pandemic has come at a time when the media and social media can be exploited to this great extent. If it had been around when we were trying to eradicate smallpox, probably something similar would have happened.
Daniela Pellaert and Yossi Mekelberg, thank you both for joining us on The Daily. Now, the 1970 World Cup remains arguably the greatest in history. It was the first to be broadcast in colour, and it was the year that Brazil won with a team featuring legends such as Pelé, Jairzinho and Rivelino. Brazilian football correspondent for Reuters, Andrew Downey, has published a new book called The Greatest Show on Earth, The Inside Story of the Legendary 1970 World Cup. Monocle's Brazilian senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, asked Downey about the meaning of this particular tournament.
Off the field, 1970, it was a turning point for football. It was an iconic World Cup because it was the last kind of World Cup of, I don't want to say the amateur era, but it was before big business and big money had invaded sport. I mean, there was no major sponsors. There was no swooshes on the chest or three lines on the shirts. And, you know, there was no boot sponsors and there was no match day minus one press conferences or anything like that. So football was still, you know, fairly innocent compared to how we see it today. And I think the main factor is probably that it was the first World Cup to be broadcast live and in colour. And I think that had a huge impact on people that were watching it because they remember seeing football for the first time in colour from the other side of the world. It was sunny, it was golden, it was the sun-drenched afternoons in Mexico. And I think that really, really had a huge impact on people's memories.
And it's nice as well that it was hosted in Mexico and again, Brazil doing so well. In a way, it was kind of a move outside just Europe and United States. It showed the kind of other kind of powers, you know, not only in sport, but even Mexico, I guess, for hosting such an event.
Well, it was the first World Cup not to be held in either South America or Europe. It was being held in North America and Mexico. So again, that was, you know, bringing football to another part of the world that hadn't seen it. But where, you know, football mad. I mean, the Mexicans are football mad. I lived in Mexico for a while and Mexico went crazy. They went crazy for their own team and then they went crazy for Brazil. When Mexico were out, the Mexicans threw their weight behind Brazil. And even today, you know, Brazilians and Mexicans have this real bond that was formed because of the whole team in 1970 and particularly in Guadalajara, which is Brazil's kind of home away from home.
That's so true. And Andrew, one thing that is fascinating about your book, I mean, I just realized actually it's been more than 50 years that this World Cup happened. So in terms of your research, you managed to talk to so many of the players. And I have to say, I mean, it was the right time for you to launch this book because I wonder if you waited another 10 years or so, it would be even harder. Because, you know, a lot of those players, that you know, they're very hard to track, difficult to speak to them. Some of them, sorry, they might not even be alive, actually.
Yeah, that's exactly true. It was a difficult book to do because when it was proposed to me, when we came up with the idea, I mean, my first thought was, wow, this is going to be great. I'm going to go around the world speaking to legends and I'll have a brilliant time. I'll go to Italy and to Germany and to Uruguay and Peru and, you know, Morocco. I'll go to all these places and it'll be, you know, it'll just be great. It took me about a week before I realized that was not going to happen. It was a real, you know, quick realization that it was going to be almost impossible to travel on the budget that I had. And also because, as you say, there's very few of these players are still alive. The ones that are still alive, even fewer of them have a really great memory of 1970. And some of them, you know, demand or ask for payment for to be interviewed. And I just didn't have the budget to be paying lots of people for their memories. So, I mean, I got around this in two ways. I mean, I tried to interview as many people as I could personally. I took a lot of information from old archive searches, from autobiographies, from previous interviews, from documentaries that had been done, you know, all that kind of archive. There's a great archive in Sao Paulo that I used that was very useful for the Brazilian players. You know, Pelé himself, he's written four autobiographies, plus a whole series about the 1970 World Cup. So these kind of things were a great help. Also, then the pandemic came around, so even if I had wanted to travel, it would have been very difficult. So what I did was I used a bunch of researchers. I got in touch with researchers and journalists in places like El Salvador, Israel, Mexico, Belgium, Sweden, all these places that the teams were not huge teams in 1970, but it was really important to me not just to talk to the players of Italy and West Germany and Brazil and Uruguay and England. I wanted to get a little bit more about these peripheral countries, countries that had been to the World Cup or were going to the World Cup for the first time, perhaps, and that also this was a big deal for them. So I got journalists, I hired journalists, and they did a fantastic job, were a great help in tracking down one or two players in these countries and doing interviews for me and getting some first-hand recollections from players from those countries.
And that's what I was surprised, actually, with the book, Andrew, because at the beginning, you know, when I saw, you know, the book, I said, oh my God, it's going to be a nice, a beautiful analysis of Brazil's victory and everything. But I didn't realize that you were going so in depth with the other countries as well. And I think for any kind of football nerd out there, I mean, it's fascinating because you don't only talk about the beautiful final between Brazil and Italy. You go even for the kind of the first round matches as well. It's a really, really interesting read.
Thank you. It's really amazing today when you look back at 1970 and realize how difficult it was for teams in a place such as Bulgaria, for example, to know about their rivals. The Bulgarians, they would put together research dossiers on their opponents from reading German newspapers. People in their foreign embassies would try and sneak into football matches or go to football matches and watch their future opponents. You know, Morocco played one game between qualifying in November 1969 and kicking off in Mexico in June 1970, because the world was so much smaller then and football was so much more exotic because these teams didn't travel as much. There was no, you know, 50 Brazilian players in the Premier League or, you know, 20 Argentines in England. You know, that kind of thing didn't happen. So that exchange just wasn't there. So it was a lot harder and it made football a lot more exotic. But it was really important for me to get these other stories because I think they really shed a light about what football was like back in that period 50 years ago.
That was Andrew Downey in conversation with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Andrew's book, The Greatest Show on Earth, The Inside Story of the Legendary 1970 World Cup, is out now. You can listen to the full interview on Monocle's The Stack this coming Saturday. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panellists today, Daniela Pellet and Yossi Meckelberg. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Louis Allen. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.